You're actually going to live it.
Why is he just lying there?
Things are always hidden.
It's really terrifying to watch.
It's like little droplets of gold falling from the sky.
You will finish this.
I could have ended up in jail.
I don't know whether that's right or not.
Suddenly.
What is that?
I love that.
Because
we're not lost people.
Oh, wow.
It's completely normal.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
Many of the new cars coming onto the market these days have automatic reverse parking. Sometimes it's hard for people to judge the space between the car and the parking spot, so when it works, it's a nice little feature. And more often, intelligent machines are there right by our side to pick up some of the tricky tasks of everyday life. They're getting better at spatial awareness, at understanding human voices, and moving through the world. Toby Walsh is my first guest today, a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of New South Wales. And he thinks that we'll be relying more and more on these intelligent machines to make a whole bunch of small decisions on our behalf. Robots will do more drudge work for us, and driverless cars are here already. The flip side of this, as he sees it, is the prospect of weapons systems that make decisions without consulting humans. And this is why Toby is a member of an international organisation called the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. And yes, that is a real thing. Hello, Toby.
Hello.
2015, your team from University of New South Wales won the World Cup of robot soccer. How many times you guys won that?
Well, we've won five times. Unfortunately, the 2016 competition was just held and we actually just lost in the final. But nevertheless, we are, with respect to the Socceroos, we are a world player in robot soccer. The only other nation that comes close, of course, is Germany.
Right. And how big are these robots that are playing against each other?
They're about knee-high. They're humanoid in shape. They play completely autonomously. We're not allowed to interact with them. Once the referee's whistle blows, then they're all on their own.
All right, so there's no one standing there with a little Xbox,
no,
little handset.
No, not at all. They have to do everything themselves.
So you're not doing anything at all to press a button to direct them at all once they start
not
playing?
Not at all. You just turn them on, and then they have to start and play themselves.
And is there a whistle, and do they hear it?
Yes, they have microphones so they can hear the whistle, and they have cameras so that they can see the ball, they've got to work together and coordinate. And the ultimate goal is by 2050 is to beat the human world champions, which will probably be Germany again.
But what happens when they make a mistake? For example, do they talk to one another in a way? Do they actually have a kind of teamwork operating between them wirelessly?
Yeah, so they have to coordinate themselves. And if they do make mistakes, I mean, there's actually a sin bin. They can get taken off and, you know, they're not allowed to obstruct the other players, and so they actually get put on the sin bin, and then they're brought on, and they have to then work out, you know, okay, where am I going to play now? And there is a dedicated goalkeeper who's always in the goal.
And what happens if the whistle goes off and one or two of them don't hear it? What happens then?
Well, then they'll end up in the sin bin.
All right, okay. And do they make agreements by consensus? Do they all go, well, if we all agree, then do this?
It's like on the football pitch, you know. You don't want to have one person who's always playing on his own. You've got to actually work as a team. You've got to actually somehow coordinate yourself. So that's part of the challenge. That's part of why it's, you know, intellectually interesting, is how you can get robots to coordinate with each other.
Of course, being robots, they'd have, you know, cameras and eyes in the front of their heads. They've got eyes in the back of their heads as
no,
well?
No, they don't. So actually, if you watch them play, and you can find videos of them on YouTube, you can see they rotate their heads from side to side quite a lot, just to, they've lost sight of the ball. They're not, that's one of the real challenges.
so they have a sense of where the ground is. They can walk towards or move quite quickly towards the ball. They see it. They understand what the ball is. They see the other players from the opposing team. They all have that mapped in their head and can act on that in real time.
Yes.
Wow. That's amazing. That's extraordinary to watch.
It is. I mean, it's still a bit slow, but, you know, it will eventually get faster and faster. And as I said, the ultimate goal is to be better than humans at this game.
There's all kinds of definitions of artificial intelligence. How do you define what artificial intelligence is, Toby?
It's a very difficult thing to define because, we can't even define the word intelligence. But, you know, one good sort of definition is it's doing the sorts of things that if you and I did them, we were thought were intelligent.
Is there a degree, does an AI have to have a degree of autonomy? Like it makes decisions, it lives in the world without a human telling it to do things?
That's a great question. We don't really know the answer to that question. There are some people who say unless you're situated in the real world, unless you're interacting with the real world, you won't really be intelligent. If we were born and we weren't allowed to interact with the real world, we wouldn't become intelligent ourselves. And so it's something that maybe emerges out of the complexity of our interactions with the world.
The theory at the moment is that we don't really become conscious until we have language.
Yes, language seems to be a critical component of our intelligence, for sure.
But these things are made of language, aren't they, really? I mean, the computer language is the thing that constructs what the mind of the AI is, isn't it?
Yes, but the computer languages are much different to, you know, natural languages, the language we use. They don't have the ability to express things, the ambiguities that language have. You know, we think in language, I think. Most of us, you know, our thoughts seem to be in the language. And, you know, it was very strange to me. I remember when I started learning French, and I dreamt one night in French. I thought, well, French is taking over my brain.
Is the best way to create an AI, then, by making something that mimics the human brain?
Again, we don't know the answer to that question. I think a good analogy, though, is to think about flight. We didn't make planes by looking at birds and standing at the end of the runway and flapping our arms. In fact, if we did that, we would still not probably be flying. And we really don't fully understand how birds fly, how feathers work, and so on. But we understood flight and built planes in a different sort of engineering way. We built it with, you know, large jet engines and fixed wings. And that was perhaps, you know, a more efficient engineering solution than one that nature found for flight.
So if we arrive at a thinking and conscious machine, we're most likely going to arrive at it from another direction then, some from that engineering direction then. Therefore, it probably might think quite differently to us if it wants to exist in the world.
It is. There's a beautiful quote from Garry Kasparov, the world chess champion, in 1997. When he was beaten, he was the first world chess champion, he was beaten by a computer, by IBM's Deep Blue. And he said at the time he could smell a new type of intelligence across the table from him.
Oh, smell's an interesting word, isn't it? Yes. That idea that kind of he got some kind of instinct of that across the table. Sometimes I wonder whether we're going to arrive at a kind of a thinking robot in the world just by creating machines that mimic humans in little ways, in doing little tasks for us to the point where they respond to us so closely they might as well be human anyway. What do you think of that?
Well, I think actually, you know, we're very quick to give intelligence to things that aren't very intelligent. We're very quick when machines behave in ways to then suddenly think they're much more intelligent. It's part of the misconception about AI that, you know, for example, earlier this year we beat the world champion Lee Sedol at Go, the ancient Chinese game of Go. That was a landmark moment. Go masters had said we'd never beat them at Go, but that's, you know, that program's an idiot savant. It can only play Go. It would take a huge amount of engineering effort even to get it to play chess. And it's certainly not going to, you know, wake up and say, look, you know, you humans, you're no good at Go. I'm going to win some money at online poker. Or, you know, what some people would like us to think, oh, you know, I'm going to take over the planet now. It's not going to do anything other than play Go.
You've just been at Griffith University's Integrity 20 conference talking about moral machines. Moral machines is an interesting phrase. Is that a contradiction in terms?
Well, yes, it's. We're certainly putting machines in places where they are making decisions with great ethical consequences. And so we have to start thinking about, you know, how do we program them with morals? We're building autonomous cars already, and they're going to have to make life or death decisions. And those decisions, they're going to have to be the decisions that we're going to, you know, be happy to live with.
Are Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics helpful here? You know, Isaac Asimov, the science fiction author who in the 50s, I think, wrote down a whole little list of laws for robots to observe. You know, first, do no harm to humans, and so on and so forth.
And second, obey all humans. And yes. Third, protect yourself. Yeah. Those laws are, I mean, they're an interesting starting point. But if you look at Asimov's stories, they're all about the mistakes and the problems. You know, what happens if you've got to choose between two different people to protect? What happens if two humans give you conflicting orders? What if one human asks you to hurt another human? So we don't understand how to program, you know, robots to behave ethically, but we're going to increasingly give them decisions and ability to act, that autonomy to act in the real world, where they're going to be making decisions with grave ethical consequences.
My first guest today is Professor Toby Walsh, who's a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of New South Wales. Where did your fascination with AI begin? Do we have to talk about science fiction here?
We do. I think, like many of my colleagues, I read far too much science fiction as a young boy and watched Doctor Who, and I mean, it's interesting. Science fiction is full of robots and intelligent computers because that's part of our future. It's very clear that that is going to be part of our future, and it's going to have a very large impact upon our lives. It's also, I mean, the thing that really, you know, also fascinated me at the time, it's one of those profound questions. It's like the question of, you know, how did the universe start? What makes us special? And it gives us an insight into those sorts of questions. You know, we are Homo sapiens, the intelligent species. We got to be the dominant species on the planet because we're the smartest. And if we can create intelligence in machines, and maybe we're not, it's unlikely that they're going to stop at our intelligence. So we're no longer going to be the smartest thing on the planet. There's going to be a new species that's even smarter. And that's going to give us some profound insight into our own intelligence and hopefully some greater, you know, humility.
One would hope. There was a famous cartoon from Punch magazine, I think in the 70s or 80s, which had a cartoon of a Dalek at the foot of a flight of stairs saying, well, that's my plans for conquering the universe, buggered then, isn't it? In a way, that speaks to a big truth, though, doesn't it? The idea of how machines, if they are to succeed, have to move successfully in the world. It doesn't matter how clever they are, they'll have to learn how to move through the world as we have learnt to move over hundreds of thousands, millions of years of adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of how we got to be where we were. We came down out of the trees, we stood up, we used our arms no longer to move but to make tools, and that's been part of our, you know, evolutionary story and our success.
You obviously have an enthusiasm for artificial intelligence. What ideally is AI for in your mind?
It's to make us healthier, wealthier and happier. And
can machines do that? I wonder, making us happier.
There's no reason that we all have to spend 24/7, you know, trying to feed ourselves and clothe ourselves and house ourselves. We could let the robots take the sweat. I like to say, you know, the vision I see in the future is that there are people dying in the third world all the time for diseases that we know how to fix. And we could put on a smartphone a program that would allow to diagnose those diseases and fix them for pennies. And you could put first world healthcare into the third world at almost no cost.
As a project you're involved with in the realm of the allocation of kidney transplants, tell me a bit about that.
Yes, so I was very pleased to get involved with how we match kidneys, donated kidneys from deceased people, to people waiting for their transplants. And unfortunately, this is becoming an increasingly challenging problem. The reason being because our roads are getting safer. It used to be the average age of donated organs was 32 in 1989. Today, it's 46. Unfortunately, fewer 18-year-old boys are donating their organs in road traffic accidents. And so that means we have to be more careful about trying to match the age of the organs to the age of the patients, something that had really been ignored until now. And so we're trying to come up with a program, a mechanism to actually do that matching more efficiently. And of course, what's really careful, we have to make sure it's very fair.
Yeah. How do you figure out the fair part of that?
Well, it's a big challenge. We want it to be fair to the donors waiting on the list. We want it to be fair to the individual states because we don't want, you know, the big states, New South Wales, to absorb all the kidneys from all the small states. So you have to be fair on many different levels. And what makes it challenging is we don't know who's going to donate their organs. At the end of the year, we could look back and say, oh, yes, we can make a perfect matching now. We know exactly whose organs are going to be donated and which patients we've got on the waiting list. But we don't have that luxury. So we have to make a decision now and live with it.
Why would an AI be able to arrive at a better and fairer decision than a human, for example?
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, the doctors actually quite like the fact that it's a program because a program, in some sense, is less biased. It doesn't, you know, have favors. It doesn't have friends it's going to call in favors for. And so it's more sort of, it's much less arbitrary. It's much more precise. You can't, you know, cheat with it.
Could doctors want to be sort of, I don't know, rescued from that decision of life and death in this case, perhaps?
I'm not sure that they're being rescued. I mean,
or alleviated, have that alleviated from them.
Perhaps there's something to that, but I mean, there's interesting aspect of if you realise that you're, there's a really interesting balancing between the individual welfare. You want to give every patient the youngest possible organ. And the collective welfare of the country, which is you don't want to give very young organs to old people because they're going to die of natural causes, and then that young organ is going to be dying in them. And you don't want to give old organs to young people because they'll fail on them and then they'll need a new transplant and then they'll be more sensitized. So you want to balance this collective welfare against this individual welfare. And the doctors don't really want to give you a formula for what that, but if we're going to write a program, you actually have to make an interesting decision. You have to pick a point that balances somehow between these two factors. So it's a really interesting, it's an example, though, we come back to, of how increasingly we're putting computers and getting them, giving them the right to make decisions that have really interesting ethical
dimensions. This is being reflected in all kinds of realms of public policy, too. Tell me about what's going on in the United States at the moment, where they're using an AI in the criminal justice system.
Yes, so there's a program called Compass, which is used to predict whether criminals are likely to reoffend in violent crime. Now, you can think of good things to do with this program. You could use it, for example, to decide how to spend limited resources, probation services, you know, say these people, they're more likely to reoffend, so we're going to give you more support and we're going to try and keep you out of jail and make society a safer place. That would seem to be a good use, but unfortunately that's not the use they're putting to the program too. They're using it to decide sentencing, deciding bail conditions, probation conditions.
Wow, really? That's extraordinary.
Right. You're now starting to feel a bit more morally dubious about this use. And then the puncher, the sucker punch here is that it was then shown that the program is biased against black people. It's more likely to predict that black people are going to reoffend. So black people are being locked up as the consequence of a mistake in a program.
So is that going to be abandoned or do people kind of, is it going ahead? Are they liking the results?
They're reassessing it, but still that program's being used in 20 states in the United States today. And it's a very worrying sign of how increasingly we're handing over decisions to algorithms, and then we have to think through the consequences. And at the end of that one, there's an even bigger philosophical question, which is, should we give computers the right to judge us? Is that something that really we should just leave to humans? I mean, that's part of our humanity. The most difficult decisions we make in our society, whether to lock people up, that's something perhaps we shouldn't give to machines. That's just something that we should just keep as part of humanity.
Yes, it's a way, again, of resigning responsibility, isn't it? Like, please, please don't give me the death sentence. And, tap, 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 computer says no. I'm sorry. That's how it goes.
Yes, I'm afraid I can't let you do that.
I can't. I'm afraid, that's just computer says no. This leads me to your involvement with a very interesting organization that I was unaware of until preparing to talk to you, Toby, which is the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. Now, this sounds like a kind of fun sci-fi convention type thing, but it's a real thing. Tell me about this organization and what you're trying to do with this organization.
So it's a collection of NGOs, Human Rights Watch and various other organizations that have come together under this umbrella campaign to actually ban what's called lethal autonomous weapons, or, the media-friendly name is, as you say, killer robots. And most people, when they hear that name, they think of Terminator. And that's wrong, because actually we're thinking of much simpler technologies that are actually much nearer. It was revealed in the New York Times this week that the U.S. Department of Defense is spending $3 billion next year on autonomous weapons. And there's an arms race going on as we speak to develop this technology.
What do you mean? Can you just talk a bit more about what you mean by autonomous weapon systems?
So most of your listeners will know about drones flying above Afghanistan or Iraq. Those are not autonomous weapons. They're just remote control. There's a soldier back in a container in Nevada who's flying that thing, and then making that final life or death decision to set off the Hellfire missile. Now, it would take a very small technical leap to replace that robot, that human, with a computer. In fact, people like the UK's Ministry of Defence said that they think it's technically possible today, and they have a demonstrator for it. And that will take us, that will be, a threshold. People have called this the third revolution in warfare. It will just transform the efficiency with which we can kill the other side. They'll be able to fly 24/7. And it's, unfortunately, one of the things is that the technology isn't really ready. We don't have the ability to write programs that could make the right ethical decisions today.
But you're saying this is coming?
This is very near. There are prototypes out there already in almost every sphere, on the land, under the sea, on the top of the sea, and in the air. There are prototype autonomous weapons being developed by militaries around the world. And there's a real arms race. The US see this as a way of having a technical lead on their opposition. The Japanese, the Chinese, the Russians, the Israelis, the UK, all see this as a way of getting humans out of the battlefield and improving the efficiency with which you can fight war. And the history of warfare is largely the one of the efficiency with which you can kill the other side.
When you say militaries, do you mean within the militaries or within the independent defense contractors, which are a lot bit harder to lobby than national governments?
Within both. I mean, DARPA, the US Defense Funding Agency has been sadly one of the biggest funders of AI research and continues today to do that. And obviously you can see the military attractions. It's very, you know, it's very attractive to get humans out of the loop.
Yeah, you can say we're offering you bloodless warfare on your side.
Exactly. But that's a misconception. It won't be bloodless because, you know, warfare now is fought in towns and cities. And the terrible things happening in Syria today demonstrate that it's the innocent people that get caught up in. So there's not a special part of the world called the battlefield where battles are going to be fought. They're going to be, again, it's going to be women and children caught up in the crossfire and will be the victims of these weapons.
The soon to be outgoing US President Barack Obama shown a lot of interest in artificial intelligence. He likes to talk about it. He had a big interview with the editors of Wired magazine about AI. He's interested in getting the US government more involved in AI research. What kind of success are you having in drawing your concerns about these issues about autonomous weapon systems to the US government?
So there have been ongoing discussions at the United Nations now for more than 3 years about putting together a ban on lethal autonomous weapons. And I'm pleased to say there's at the main disarmament conference, which happens in Geneva in December this year, they are going to approve what's called a governmental group of experts, the next stage in trying to formalize some legislation. But sadly, the US has been probably one of the largest opponents to any type of ban.
How smart can an AI get? Do we have any idea of the parameters of that at this stage?
We don't. I mean, it really is an interesting scientific question. It's one of the biggest scientific questions I think we can ask is, you know, is there any limit to intelligence? And I think one of the things that we should have learned from the history of science is that any time that we think we're special, we were wrong. The sun, you know, didn't go around the earth. We were no more special than the apes. You know, Copernicus, Darwin taught us that whenever we put ourselves on a pedestal, we were wrong. And so to think there's something inherently special about our own intelligence, I suspect, is going to be wrong.
I did a fair bit of thinking and did a TV thing about this issue some years ago, about 13 years ago, and the thinking back then was that Moore's Law, which is the theory articulated by Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel, was going to rapidly progress the abilities of artificial intelligence. It meant that computer processing power doubled every 18 months to 2 years or so. Where's Moore's Law at now?
Well, sadly, I'm afraid to report that Moore's Law is dead. Intel have formally declared that the Moore's Law is dead.
When did that happen?
You run into quantum limits. You run into the fact that you make things too small, then the electrons jump over and it becomes too quantum noisy. And so they've stopped the ambition to try and actually make circuits any smaller, and instead they're actually trying to make circuits more power efficient, so that with all our mobile devices that we can use them, and so our smartphones don't catch light because they don't use so much energy.
Because the thinking was back then was that if Moore's Law continues on its merry path, this kind of exponential increase in processing power, sometime around about 2030, that we'd come up with a machine that could equal the human mind in processing power, and at that point, it was said at the time by some very clever people, the machine would most likely wake up in a way. It would become conscious. It would become a thinking machine that would live in the world and have ideas and speak and create things like we do. What's that thinking at now?
Well, so the date's been pushed back to 2045.
Really?
So like most things, yep. It takes a bit longer to get there. But you know, the human brain is the most complicated system that we know of in the universe by orders of magnitude. Nothing approaches the billions of neurons, the trillions of connections in our human brain. So we shouldn't be so surprised. It might take another 15 years or so to get computers as complex as the human brain. And Moore's Law has certainly brought us huge advances. The fact that your smartphone can do all those things it can is because of Moore's Law. But even exponential growth, exponential growth is great, but some of the problems we're tackling are even worse than exponential in how they scale. And so exponentials are not enough.
Do you think it'll ever be possible, though? What's your suspicion? I mean, we can't know for sure. Do you ever think there is such a possibility for a conscious thinking machine that would we may have to give rights to because it might be able to be hurt or killed? What do you think about all that?
Well, consciousness is, it's the hard problem. We don't understand consciousness. We don't begin to understand consciousness. In fact, that's one of the reasons I'm fascinated by AI, because maybe it will give us some insight into consciousness. Maybe we will build systems and they will be so complex that suddenly it's one of these things that emerges out of that complexity. We don't know. We don't know. I mean, another important aspect of our lives is our emotions. We don't understand why we have emotions. I mean, they're clearly a big part of our lives. Evolution allowed them to evolve, and they seem to be really important. Are we going to have computers with emotions? And how's that connected to consciousness?
One of the best theories I heard about AI is that if you did get that self-aware machine at some point that woke up, it would rapidly self-improve. It would figure out how to improve itself much more quickly than we could. And then it wouldn't so much want to take over the world. It would quickly become bored with us and take off into space and live as some kind of vast immortal intelligence. And maybe the hardest, the most terrible thing that might come out of a self-aware, self-improving AI is that it just would dump us. It would regard us as a bit of a boring old waste of time.
Yes, I think we're back to that point where I said, maybe give us some more humility.
Indeed. Great to speak with you, Toby, and thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Professor Toby Walsh is Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of New South Wales, and he was one of the speakers this week at Griffith University's Integrity Summits.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on your mobile.
There's a photo image that hit the front page of the Melbourne Age on Melbourne Cup Day back in 1977. The picture is of a veteran trainer named Tommy Woodcock. Tommy's a man in his 70s. He's wearing boots and braces, and he's in the stable of his champion stallion, which was the cup favourite that year, a horse called Reckless. But Tommy's not standing next to his horse. He's lying down on a lilo, on the straw, right next to Reckless, who's also lying down. And Tommy's reaching out and affectionately scratching the horse's huge muzzle. And the horse's eyes are closed in this lovely state of sleepy happiness. It's a really touching image of friendship and trust. The photographer who took the picture was Bruce Possel. Bruce was a press photographer for 50 years, working mostly with the Melbourne Age, and Bruce covered pretty much every aspect of Australian life. He took pictures of prime ministers and sporting heroes and many more of everyday Australians going about their lives. And he found this very human and relatable quality in all of them. To find these revealing moments, Bruce Possel pretty much kept a camera around his neck whenever he was awake. In his own quiet way, he was a driven man. He could often see the moment before it happened and be standing by, camera in hand, when it did happen. And when his pictures hit the front page, as they so often did, he gave Australians a deeper understanding of themselves. Bruce Possel is now retired, and he's been putting together a collection of books, 10 in all, which showcase his greatest images from the worlds of politics, sport, animals, and entertainers. Hello, Bruce. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Richard.
That picture of Tommy Woodcock lying there on the lilo next to Reckless the horse, what did you tell your picture editor about the 1977 Cup Day front page?
I told him 3 weeks before the Cup not to worry about the Melbourne Cup Day picture, that I had it. And it was in the locker, and I wasn't going to show it to him before Cup Day, because he would have used it. I didn't have it in the locker. It hadn't been taken. It was in my head. And I chased Tommy for 3 weeks, and he kept saying to me, no, Bruce, I'm not going to do it because I'm 74, and if people see me sleeping with a horse, they might think I'm funny. So I kept at him and got the same answer, and on the night before the Cup, I was getting pretty desperate. And I left the office at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, drove home first and picked up a lilo, went down to the stables and sat outside the horse's stall, blew the lilo up, put it on the straw, and this was a stallion. Most stallions don't like anything else in their stall. They'll tear it apart. I took a big risk because this horse was favourite for the Melbourne Cup the next day. Tommy was in the stable. I went down and I said to him, Tommy, I've got something to show you. And he came up with me and he looked around the corner and Reckless was standing there looking at this lilo. He said, Bruce, he said, you've got a lot of trouble. He said, I'll do it for you. So he went in and he lay down on this lilo. And I said to him, Tommy, it doesn't make a picture until this horse comes down near you. He looked at Reckless. Reckless looked at him, and this big stallion dropped down and put his head on his chest. And Tommy reached up, tickled him under the neck, and the horse closed the tires, and I took two photos. That's all I took.
This was a wordless command, was it? Horse did this without any kind of command?
No commands, no. He just looked at him.
Once you'd taken the photo?
I walked out of there 3 feet off the ground. I couldn't believe what I'd achieved, because I really didn't think that it would work. I mean, I had thought there was no chance of getting that horse down near him, and it had happened in front of me, and I shot the picture. And I got back to the office, and I walked in, and they'd held picture conference. And Ray Blackburn, the picture editor, said, "Where the hell's that bloody picture?" He said, "I've looked through your locker." He said, "I've turned it upside down." I said, "I could see that. The locker was turned upside down, and everything was out on the floor." He said, "Where's the picture of the man and the horse together?" And I put my hand in my shirt pocket and pulled out the metal cassette. And I held it between my thumb and the forefinger, and with my index finger I pointed to it. And he said, "You're not going to tell me that you've just taken that picture. We've held picture conference. I've told the editor about it, what a great picture it is." He said, "I've never seen it." He said, "He's accepted it for page one and he's never seen it. If it's not as good as what you told me it was 3 weeks ago, the editor will sack me and I'll sack you." And I ran in and I did. I came back out with a 15-inch by 12-inch print, and I put it in front of him, and he said, "Wow." And he ran up to where the editor was and put it in front of the editor, and they immediately increased the size of it from the one side of the front page to the other.
And what's that like then, once that's printed the next day on Melbourne Cup Day? You actually see that beautiful picture on the front page of a major metropolitan newspaper.
I covered the Melbourne Cups year in, year out. And everywhere I went, I heard people talking about this amazing picture on the front page of the paper. And I went down to where Tommy, they've got to be there 2 hours before the race. And he was in his stable. And I walked up, and Tommy didn't say anything. He just walked over and he hugged me. And then he looked at me and he said, "Bruce," he said, "that's a lovely, lovely photo." One of the reasons that I took this picture was because Tommy Farlap died in his arms from poison when he was 18 in Mexico.
Oh, he was the strapper with Farlap?
Yes.
Right.
And he had such an amazing relationship with Australian racing, and that was another reason I wanted desperately to get that picture.
You shot a lot of politicians, prime ministers, premiers along the way. Malcolm Fraser, Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser, you shot many times over the years. What was the first time you actually got an election photo of him?
When he won his first election, and he and Tammy were in the crowd dancing on the floor of the Southern Cross at midnight or later. And I shot this picture looking across all the faces and the two of them looking up at one another and smiling, and it was just a lovely picture. But then I went to him and I said, "Mr. Fraser, when you contest the next election and you win that," I said, "I want to go further and get a shot of the two of you having breakfast at the table in the Windsor." And he said yes. And he won it, and I walked in Sunday morning at about 6:45 in the morning, I suppose, and Tammy was sitting at one end of the table reading the paper, Malcolm at the other end reading the paper, and I said, "Just stay as you are," and I took that picture. And then I went to him and I said, "Now, the next election, Mr. Fraser, I want a shot of you lying in bed reading the paper."
And what did he say to that?
Well, he said, "It might be all right." He was a great amateur photographer, and he was interested in how I went about looking for these pictures, asking for them, etc. And he said, yes, that might be possible. But Tammy turned around, she said, "No." She said, "You can't do this to him. He's got to have a day off somewhere where he can sleep late." You
know? Right.
I was covering that election that night, and he came in. He said to me at the Southern Cross at about 12:15, he said, "Bruce," he said, "be there at 6 o'clock. And I got up at 4, drove down, and I picked up a Sunday, what do they call it, the Sunday Observer, which was printed out of town. Then I went and got a Sunday Press and made my way up to the Southern Cross, where I pulled up outside and his guards met me and took me upstairs to the door, and Tammy opened the door and she said, "Bruce," he said, "Malcolm's in bed and there, take them in." And I gave them to him, and she said, "I'm not going to be in this picture." Anyway, I took 3 frames and I said, "That'll do me." And I was standing talking to him, and I'd opened up this big window to get some light in. I didn't want to use flash, and I used available light in the first pictures. And the phone rang, and he leant over and he picked it up. And it was his son ringing from Broken Hill to congratulate him on his win. And he threw his head back and laughed and bang.
That was it, right.
Yeah.
So were you
just
hanging back waiting for the right moment?
I shot it from the hip. I didn't know he was. I didn't realise that he was going to do that. And I was quite happy with the first picture I'd taken anyway. I had the camera in my hand. I shot it from the hip.
One time you ran into Jeff Kennett and his wife Felicity in a pizza restaurant having a meal and a glass of red wine. How did you approach him then?
Well, I saw them there. I was on another assignment, and I just went straight into the pizza shop, and I walked up and shook Jeff by the hand. I said, and his wife, Felicity, and I said, Mr. Kennett, I was referred to him as Mr. Yeah, I said, Mr. Kennett, I said, any chance of a quick picture of you pouring a glass of wine for Felicity? And he said, sure. Beautiful, happy picture of the two of them. And then I said to him, have you ever thrown a pizza? And he said, no. I said, would you like to? He said, yes. And I went out, to the kitchen, and I said to the owner of the place, I said, look, any chance of getting Mr. Kennett in here and throwing a pizza? He said, sure. He and his son got in the picture as well, and his son's going, wow, like this, and, you know, and the pizza spinning above the three of them, they're also, it's just a lovely picture.
I noticed you asked him rather than just snapped it. Would you ever do that, just snap a picture without asking permission first?
If you're in a news situation, yes, you've got to.
But in a private moment?
But in a private moment, your best bet's to go and ask them or just to tell them that you're going to do it.
And if they say no, what would happen then?
It never happened to me, to be quite honest with you. I never had a knockback ever. But there was, when Jeff Kennett was leader of the opposition, somebody threw the hat in the ring to try and take it off him. He walked out of the meeting, held his hands up, and he said, I'm still the leader. And everybody took a picture of him doing that. And I thought, that's not what I want. And I sat back for 2 hours while the TV channels all had their one-on-one interviews with him about him retaining the leadership. And 2 hours later, I followed him back to his office, and I still didn't know what I was going to get, but I followed him at a discreet distance. And when he went into his office, the office that those in opposition were a lot smaller than those that were in power. And so I pushed a seat up outside the door and sat there, and I heard him pick up the phone.
Through the door?
Yeah. He was talking pretty loudly, and he said, yeah, Flicker. He said, I'm still the leader. He said, I'll meet you on the steps of Parliament House in 10 minutes. And I thought, that'll do me. And I walked out, waited for him to come out. And I was on the parapet at the end of the... So I climbed up on there, and I was sitting up there waiting for him to come out. So I'm looking down on him. And he looked at me, and he said, what are you doing here? And I said, just about to take a photo of Felicity running up the steps and hugging and kissing you. And he looked at me, he said, how do you know that? I said, I heard you on the phone. He said, fair enough. And she did exactly that. She got out of the car, ran up the stairs, and they hugged and gave one another a kiss. He kissed her on the cheek, and I took a series of pictures of it. But the thing about it was that was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, steps of Parliament House, and there wasn't one other person on the steps of Parliament House. Normally at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd have school children standing there with bags and that hand. All those pristine white steps of Parliament House just disappear into the background, and the two of them are there hugging and kissing. They're just beautiful.
I'm with Bruce Possel. Bruce was a photographer for the Melbourne Age for many decades and commandeered the front page of the paper on many, many occasions, taking photos of politicians, sporting figures and everyday people involved in the drama of life. There's some images you've got of a bunch of dogs. Now, this is how simple it can be sometimes. It's not a prime minister, it's not a premier or a powerful human being. It's just two dogs. It's a cattle dog and a pup. And in a series of interactions that you just happened to catch. What was the story there, Bruce?
I was on another assignment there at the farm, and we saw the owner coming back on a motorbike with the dog on the back of the bike. And he drove past us and pulled up just to our right. But as he went past, I shot a picture of it. The cattle dog jumped off, went over, sat outside the house. The pup, a Rottweiler pup, came up and placed his paw right in the middle of this dog's head. Now, the dog had been out in 40-degree heat rounding up cattle.
Wasn't in a good mood, right.
And the cattle dog's head spun and he spat at him. You can see the tongue is like a little... he curled the tongue up and he spat at him. Get out of my way. The pup is going backwards. He's still got his paw out in front of him and his eyes are like saucers. He's just been told off in no uncertain terms. The cattle dog got up and walked away. The pup ran after him, bit him on the neck, and he was shrugged off. He then bit him on the bum, and the cattle dog lifted his leg and peed in his face. And it's made one of the most remarkable series. The thing about it is that you never know where your next picture's coming from. But I can't tell you what made me turn around and do the second picture of him sitting against the wall of the house. I didn't even see the pup at that stage, and the pup came out of left field, and the rest of it took place.
So you have to be ready for anything to happen then, and be standing by and waiting for it. You took a wonderful shot of Bob Hawke and the Queen at the races, and it's an amazing image because it's a real study in contrast. It's just this great snap, and he's the Prime Minister, she's the Queen. He's very Australian. He's shouting. He seems to be shouting.
Breaking all the protocol rules.
Protocol, yes. He's sitting right next to the Queen, who's very still. He's dressed like a lair. She's very dowdy. He's Australian. She's British. What was going on there in that picture?
She was watching the Queen Elizabeth Stakes in Canberra. They were right at the top of the grandstand, and... the light was shocking because the sun was going down and it was behind the where they were sitting, and so the light was shocking. There was about 30 to 40 English photographers covering the tour, and they all made an instant decision amongst themselves that nobody would bother about the picture up there because the light wasn't good enough. And they went and did the finish of the race and then were waiting for the Queen to come down to do the presentation.
That's boring, though, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was the only one that stayed there, I think. I don't think there was another photographer around, and if there was, I've never seen the picture. But anyway, I was left there on my own, and Hawke jumped to his feet. He backed the winner and the Queen, backed the horse that ran second. And Hawke was up over the top, and he was... he was screaming for this horse to win the race, and it just made a fantastic photo.
Taking pictures of just people in the streets, a whole other art as well. Tell me about how you managed to get a beautiful shot of a homeless woman who's pushing a trolley in front of her, casting this remarkable shadow.
I was driving down Punt Road, peak hour traffic. I'm going out of town, going away from the city, and I saw this lady pushing a trolley along the footpath. When I first saw her, there was no shadow behind her because there was no fence or anything there. But I parked the car up a one-way street the wrong way and jumped out with a 300mm lens and ran back to Punt Road. And I'm looking across four lanes of traffic, or six lanes of traffic it might have been, I think, and there were trucks and everything there, and I got one frame. It was the only gap that I saw between cars and trucks. And by that time, she was walking past a brick fence, and the early morning sunlight threw this amazing shadow of her on the fence behind her. And I shot one frame and then it was gone again. Truck went past, and by the time the truck had cleared the area of the picture, the brick fence had finished and the shadow had disappeared. So I was very lucky in that respect.
What happens when you showed that to the boss, though?
Showed it to the editor. And the editor said to me, "You've got a great picture here, Bruce, but we're not running it until you get permission to find her." It took me 3 days to track her down. And I showed her the photo and I asked her, could I use it? And she said, she knew my name by then, I told her who I was. And she said, "Bruce, I'd love to see myself on the front page of The Age." And so I took it back and I told the editor, and they ran it. They ran the picture the next day.
One day when Paul Keating was Prime Minister, you went to take a photo of Paul Keating at Spencer Street Railway Station in Melbourne. What was that for?
He hammered in the last spike of the line between Perth and Cairns. That was where the lines joined. he was there to hammer the hammer in the spike and then officially open the line. And he was standing there speaking into a microphone, and had the train behind him, and I thought, what a boring picture. And I saw a mate of mine from Newcastle, and I said to him, photographer friend, and I said to him, he had his daughter there, and I said, can you send her up and ask her to stand next to Paul Keating? And she not only went up there, but she put her hand in her mouth and was holding this little thing and looked up at him, shot the picture, front page picture.
Makes the picture suddenly more human.
You had to sort of create photos in a lot of aspects. A lot of the photos were created, I've got to say.
How do you get people to relax in front of the camera, Bruce?
How do you get them to relax? God, in most cases I went up and talked to them about anything else but what they were there for. Might be horse racing, might be cricket, might be whatever.
Because most of the time they're not looking at the camera, they're just in the process of doing something else.
Yeah, exactly. That was what made the job so interesting. I mean, it was, every day was different. You met people from all walks of life, and 99% of them let you take their photo.
Tell me about the near-death experience you had, Bruce, on a plane in New Zealand.
There was Clive McKinnon from The Sun and I sitting in the back seat of a six-seater plane. Keith Hillier, the Sun racing rider, was sitting in the centre seat on his own, and Glenn Lester, the Age racing rider, was sitting up with the pilot. And we were flying from the Hamilton racecourse to the light aircraft airport at Auckland. We're coming into land, and I'm sitting in the back camera around my neck, always carried a camera around my neck in a light plane, reading the paper. I just had that feeling that something was wrong, and I dropped the paper down, and here's Hillier in front of me going away from the seat. He's getting further back from the seat like this, from the window. He's pushing himself back in his seat, and I could see this plane outside, and anyway, I dropped the paper, grabbed the camera, went bang, shot a picture of it. Our pilot at the last minute saw this plane coming across us, or about to come across us, and he dropped the nose a fraction, and I went head first. I didn't have my seatbelt on, and I went head first into the seat in front of me, still in time to grab another picture at the vacant window in the centre of the plane on the left-hand side, with the plane just outside the window. And then I threw myself back and took a third picture as it went away.
How close was the plane?
3 metres.
3 metres?
Yes. That was the official estimation from the people in the control tower.
Why aren't you dead, Bruce?
It's a good way to finish the interview. But Clive McKinnon looked at me. He watched me take the photo, and he said, you know, Posse, he said, if the camera had survived the crash and somebody processed the film, you would have won the Walkley Award posthumously. Which I thought was a lovely comment, considering that he made it within a couple of seconds of me taking the third picture.
You left the Age about 20 years ago, after almost three decades there. But you're not really retired, are you, Bruce?
No, I mean, I bought out a book called The Image Maker 5 years ago, which sold out, and we were approached by a firm press in Melbourne to do 10 books in 2 years and 3 months. Each book's on a different subject. We're working on the sixth one at the moment, and that's animals, but there's politics, news and weather to come. It gives me now probably one of the best files of photos that probably anyone's taken in Australia, I'd say.
Well, it's a stunning body of work, Bruce. These pictures are so arresting to look at, and they're in their own way very artful and quite amazing. And it's been such a pleasure to speak with you today, Bruce, and thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Richard.
Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
Bruce Possel's books are called Iconic Images from 50 Years of Australian Life.
won't admit you love me. And so, how am I ever to know? You always tell me, perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. A million times I've asked you, and then I ask you over again. You only answer, perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. If you can't make your mind up, we'll never get started. And I don't want to wind up being parted, broken hearted. So if you really love me, say yes. But if you don't, dear, confess. And please don't tell me, perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. Perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. If you can't make your mind, if you really love me, say yes. But if you don't, dear, confess. And please don't tell me, perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. Perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. Perhaps, perhaps.
There you go. Very saucy Doris Day there with Perhaps, Perhaps, Perhaps. Today's conversations with Toby Walsh and Bruce Possel will be up on our website in an hour or so, abc.net.au/conversations. And, of course, you can podcast this program through the app that's probably sitting on your smartphone. I'm Richard Feidler.